Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Kaiming Chang, author of Beast Theory, her first novel, published in September by One World Random House. Ming is a poet first. Listen to her reading on YouTube. It's particularly symmetry, and I watched her eat the apple. I saw that because much of the language, and I saw that because I was researching for the interview, but much of the language in Bestiary mirrors to a certain extent the ebb and flow, the song of her poetry. So this is a book I think you never thought you would read. Its language and its story are very decipherable, but as you jump in, you're not sure this is the case. As you are drawn further into the three generations of women and their impossible but believable lives, you realize this is a place you haven't been to before. And I always think about this, but as Archibald MacLeish said in Ars Poetica, a poem should not mean but be. And this book sounds like it should not be there, but it is, and thank goodness it is. So welcome, Ming, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction and for commenting on my poetry. It means a lot to me. Thank you.
You're welcome. So normally, and you'll see as we go along, that I ask a lot of extraneous questions. But since I've listened and you do it so beautifully, if you could just go ahead and tell us about the book, because I couldn't explain it to you here.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, even I have trouble explaining it, but I have my copy here to show to the camera. My book starts off with three generations of Taiwanese American women, and it's propelled by the third generation in the book. She goes by daughter in the novel, and she grows a tiger tail overnight. And has to kind of excavate her family history in order to understand the root of this tale, where it came from, why she has it. And that's everything kind of spirals out of that.
So show the cover of the book again, because I own an independent bookstore and
my background will try to erase it. There yeah, we go.
I have it here. So, oh, that's good. So I own a bookstore. So everyone always says you can't judge a book by its cover. But every single person who comes into my
judges
store.
Judges a book by a cover.
Yeah, and I remember you talking about how you used to love the library when you were a kid, and I bet you did the same thing when you started out. So anyway, on the cover is like the whole book, but you don't realize it until you read the whole book. But hold it up again, and I'll just try and say, okay, so you see the tail, and you also see bones, which play in very much in the book. You see the bird, and what am I missing? You see, oh, the whole.
Letters.
Yeah, the letters.
The holes.
And the hole where the tail grows out of. So yeah. It's kind of, who came up with that? Did you vet it?
I do love that it's a bit of a treasure map. It's like a scavenger hunt on the cover. Like it all makes sense. And on the inside flap, you get the head of the goose, which is great. But no, it was designed by Michael Morris, who's absolutely brilliant. And it's like the cover of my dreams. And I'm really glad you noticed how the elements later on kind of fit in with the book. Yeah.
You know what it's like? It's like before you read the book, you look at the cover and it's like looking at the outside of a jigsaw puzzle box where the picture is. And then when you go inside, you got all the pieces and you realize, oh, okay, you got to put it together using the cover of the box. So that's one thing that I always start out with. But then the next thing, because I know you worked real hard at it, are the two epigraphs, which must have taken you some time. And the first one is from Lee Young Lee's The Winged Sea. The name of the river is what it says. So I tried to correlate that to the book, and it's kind of like, you know how in Buddhism you can't step in the same river twice?
Yeah.
So what made you think of that one?
I'm so glad you mentioned the epigraphs, because they're my favorite part of the book, honestly. I'm like, you don't need to read my writing. Just read the two authors who are in the beginning, who are such foundational writers. The reason why I love this quote is it does very much correlate with the book and the recurrence of rivers throughout the book. I like to think of the shape of the structure of the novel to be very river-like as well, that it meanders and doesn't follow a kind of traditional climactic plotted path. And then thinking of like the idea of the name of the river is what it says, I was exploring a lot in this book, like indigenous Taiwanese storytelling. and this idea that the name of the land and the rivers have been continually erased and renamed, and by various people, various colonial powers, various authorities, and thinking about, like, what would it mean if the river were its own body, were its own entity with its own agency? What would the river name itself? Like, what would it say? And to fully kind of animate the water rather than it being kind of this passive thing that we manipulate. So it just felt so kind of perfectly aligned with the spirit of the book. Yeah.
And it also aligns very closely with some of the language of the book. It's phrased in the way the language of the book is phrased as well. But then the second epigraph from Maxine King's Hawaii One Summer, it's very simple and it's funny, which is, there is a lot of detailed doubt here, which sounds like my life.
Yes.
So, yeah, and when you read the book, especially the first, when you're in like the first 100 pages, you're not quite, like I said in the introduction, you're not quite sure. It's really great reading it because it's so much fun, but you're not quite sure because there is a lot of doubt, whether it's gold or, you know, whether it's holes in the ground or whether it's letters flying out. It's like, and I think this is really good because you leave it up to the reader, you know, like the reader is the one who's going, what the hell is going on?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I really did want to kind of disorient the reader in a lot of ways. And I love that idea of detailed doubt because I feel like all of my writing and so much writing that I love is just detailed doubt. And I love, there's a writer named Elaine Castillo who wrote America is Not the Heart. And she taught a workshop talking about like doubt and how that is such a powerful place in fiction, or a generative thing in fiction, that so much springs from doubt, so much conflict, so many interesting themes. So it drives everything forward. And I just love that idea of embracing the chaos, embracing uncertainty, and letting doubt drive the story. And it, because it is a story about storytelling, about all the various versions of the stories that the daughter consumes and all these conflicting histories, I just felt like doubt was such an important cornerstone word for this book. And Maxine Honkingson being one of my influences as well, I just thought it would be really beautiful to name her too.
And just as a sideline, I did interview Elaine, like I guess 2 years ago.
Oh, really? Oh, amazing. Yeah. Incredible.
Because I love that book.
I love that book so much.
So sometimes when I talk to authors like David Mitchell or someone like that, from I spoke with Isabel Allende, which was amazing.
Oh, incredible. Yeah.
And she was so nice. But anyway, some authors, like if I say the word magical realism, they embrace it. Some get kind of pissed off at me. But yours really is. So I guess the first question about that I have to ask, well, Isabel Allende is one, but as you were growing up in the library every day, like me too, were you reading Gabriel Garcia Marquez?
Oh, this is such a funny thing, you mentioning this, because I had never read actually a work of magical realism before I wrote this book.
Really?
I read Maxine Honkingston. She uses, it's kind of fabulism, and Helen Oyeyemi similarly is kind of a fabulous writer in that oftentimes she draws from folktale mythology and there are magical elements in her work. And similarly with Maxine Honkingston, there's this very kind of fluctuating reality. But I never read kind of the, you know, like the cornerstones of magical realism, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. That actually happened after I finished editing and writing. And I remember thinking that in a lot of ways, I don't feel like I've earned a spot in the magical realist canon. I also think that it is very culturally specific as well. And I don't want to kind of, presume that I'm part of that canon. But I feel like our vocabulary is so limited. That we for kind of describing different kinds of realism, that magical realism is kind of the only one that if I said it, people would recognize it. And so that's why I use it. But I'm always searching for more precise, more kind of culturally accurate language for it. And then interestingly, after this book was published, I read a book called Three Brothers by Yen-Lin Ke. And it's a memoir. And he was writing about spiritual realism, and not spiritual as in like Zen or meditating, but like spiritual as in like spirits and ghosts, and how he considers himself, like he's a, he was a Chinese writer. He is a Chinese writer who was very influenced by writers like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, very influenced by different canons. And he kind of formulated his own form of realism that he called spiritual realism, of like kind of this porous, surreal reality, because in his writing, like, the surreal reality is the only one that exists. Like, this idea of literary realism just doesn't exist in his world, and I really relate to that. So I'm like, oh, maybe I should kind of start to invoke the spirit of Yen Lin Ko when I'm talking about the kind of tradition that I'm writing toward. But yeah, I'm always looking for more precise language for that, basically.
Well, also, I think, like I said, I would say it anyway, it seems like it stems from poetry. And then when you read your poems afterwards, you can see the same type of musical quality to the book.
Yeah, and I think metaphor is a kind of magic in that, you know, to say something is something else, like, that's also a process of transformation. That's also in kind of a speculative space. So yeah, that space of metaphor to me is always kind of magical. Yeah.
There's lots of things, though, in the book. Well, first of all, it's like, I almost want to go, young lady, do not use language like that in a book, please. Because I'm old and you're young, and it's like, I'm thinking, how is she using words like piss and shit over and over again, like repetitively? And it's really interesting because it changes the nature of the words. They don't mean what you're saying anymore. Mm-hmm. But they're throughout. So how did that happen? How did you like, okay, I'm going to use this language to move the story along?
Well, it actually, I wasn't even thinking about it. Like, I didn't even realize how many times I'd used it until, you know, my editor pointed it out and readers pointed out. Like, for me, I didn't realize it. I was like, oh, really? Like, I had no idea I was writing shit that many times. Like, I had absolutely no consciousness of it. To me, I was like, oh, it's just, you know, this lyrical, you know, thing I'm writing. So yeah, I think it came very naturally for me. And I think part of that is, you know, on one hand, my literary influences, I love Jenny Zhang's work, Sour Heart. That's a book that's like full of bodily functions and all kinds of things. And all the books that I read, I think kind of integrate things that are kind of considered gross or disgusting into the language in some way. And so it was very, very natural part of my writing vocabulary. And also, you know, I grew up around people who weren't really ashamed to be speaking that way and who found it's very natural to kind of just talk about one's bodily functions. And that came out of a place of intimacy rather than shock or disgust or, it came out of this closeness. Of like, we are so kind of close and intimate that like we can talk about our bodies, we can talk about things and not feel not feel embarrassed. I realized that the kind of grotesque elements and the beauty that I wanted to write as well, that they were kind of inseparable from each other, and I couldn't really write one without the other. Yeah.
Yeah, the good thing about an iPad is I can look up how many times you've used a word. So, like 85 times for one.
It's a lot, yeah.
Well, and it's funny too, because so much of the book deals with bodily functions or parts of the body or toes that are eaten and then eaten again, or like peanuts. And so at the beginning, when I don't want to spoil anything, but I've read the reviews, so I won't say anything else that they haven't said. But when Ba essentially swallows gold,
right,
and a good portion of the first part of the book is just trying to retrieve that gold.
Right.
And it's all based on stuff that's inside the body or around the body. And that plays through the entire book. And then, go ahead and just... You did slightly or somewhat when you were talking about bodily functions, but how did you decide to focus so closely on human bodies, how they interrelate, and the absurd and impossible things that happens to them, like the cover suggests?
Yeah, I love that you use the word absurd. I think that's really kind of true to the spirit of the book. Yeah, I think for me, I mean, I'm always... really interested in, yeah, like the relationship between hunger and desire and consumption, and the way that history is so totally embodied, like that incident you mentioned of Bob, the grandfather figure, swallowing the gold. That was out of desperation and necessity and like fleeing a war. And it's like, oh, what do I do with this object? What can I do besides carry it inside me? And I think that thread kind of continues throughout the book of like, what do we do with history? We carry it in our bodies. We pass it down through this kind of bodily knowledge. And it's just completely, it's not something that's like intellectually known or understood. Everything is first experienced through the body. So that's what I was really interested in is what do you inherit? Is it possible to inherit memories through the body? Is it possible to inherit things that you don't kind of consciously know about, but that are inside you and kind of manifest in these strange ways, like growing the tiger tail, or, you know, an obsession with hoarding things? Like, yeah, that's what I was interested in.
Well, do you think that's true? Do you believe in that?
Ah, that's interesting. Yeah, I do definitely believe that intergenerational trauma is passed down through the body and that it's possible to kind of remember something that didn't happen to you in a very like non-intellectual way, not literally remembering it, but somehow it's in your body. Somehow it's in your instincts, in the way that you carry yourself, in the way that you, yeah, mimic others too. Like I definitely do think that is passed down to a certain extent. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny for me, and I'm not really a spiritual person, which makes it even more weird, is that every once in a while, you know, it's like Pink Floyd song, Comfortably Numb. You know, you turn to the side and you see something out of the corner of your eye, but then you look back and it's not there anymore. But you know you've seen it.
Yeah.
And so it alters the nature of reality for you. And then unless you're really cynical, you don't forget it. You remember it for the rest of your life.
It's
a seminal point. It's a moment of epiphany.
Yeah, and there's also so much science too about epigenetics and how your experiences can literally change your genes. By experiencing something, your genes can change and then you pass on those genes. So living through something can literally change your entire lineage, your entire body. And I was also like thinking a lot about that too. Not that I think that science needs to validate it in us in order for us to understand the core of its truth, but that entire field of study I think feels really relevant to the book.
Yeah, definitely. And I end up talking about myself half the time.
Oh, but no worries. I love hearing other stories and thoughts. Yeah.
Well, I live in this house that was built in 1775, which is nothing for China or England, but it's old for here. And when I first moved in, I realized it has a pond. And I realized when I sat by the pond that there must have been six generations of people before me sitting by the pond, thinking exactly the same thing I was thinking as I was looking at the pond. And it really, or sitting in front of the fireplace and knowing that there had been this person and this person and this person and this person before me doing exactly the same thing, thinking the same thing. And that resonated in me when I was reading the book, which prompts me to ask you to tell the reader a little bit more about how the three generations interplay, because at the book, you're not quite sure. And then it becomes clear.
Yeah. Well, I was really interested in how these three generations would kind of become melded together. Like by the end, the daughter kind of mimics the grandmother's speech in that like last kind of perforated section, not to spoil the ending. And all three generations kind of share vocabulary. They have similar themes and words running throughout. So I was really interested, rather than thinking of them as like extremely distinct, or that each generation represents like, oh, a new branch, a new break, we're starting anew, like very against this kind of tabula rasa, blank slate idea, rather that they are kind of one continual line, and that everything there is no kind of like, wiping the slate clean, that they each kind of encroach on each other's lives. And also the fact that they're nameless and they all are daughters and they all are mothers and they're all called that at different points in time, except for the daughter, obviously. To me, it felt very true to my lived experience and to the experience of these women who aren't necessarily known by name, but known by role. Because rather than kind of emphasizing a certain kind of individuality, it's about this continuance of like, I am both, I, you know, am now daughter. I was once a mother. You are now called the same thing I was called. There's just this like tetheredness between the three generations. And so I know that can also be confusing for readers as well, because, you know, Ama is also called Ma, and it's just name wise, it can be a little bit confusing, but that was purposeful to me, because to me, they were all kind of one continuous body and lineage, rather than being super like distinct from each other. Yeah.
When you say when you compare it to your own lived experience, tell me more about that.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mentioned this, I talked about this earlier with someone, and I was saying that, like, I don't really know the names of my family members, that we all know each other by role. I didn't know my grandparents' names. I still don't know my grandparents' names. I remember one time, or not one time, but, like, many, many times, you know, I was with my grandmother, and my grandmother would say, you know, Maymay, which means, like, the youngest daughter, little sister, and my mom would turn her head and answer. And I was like, that you can't do that. Like, that's me. Like, you can't, that's me. Like, that's my name. I'm Maymay. Why are you turning your head? And then I realized, oh, because my mother is also a Maymay. Like, we're both, that we're kind of, that we have this shared role. And that was really shocking. It was a shocking moment for me, because I was always just continually confused. And I was like, who is she calling? You know, is she calling my mother? Is she calling me? And that was never like fully differentiated. And I was like, oh, I guess there's just this kind of resonance. I felt this like really intense, like intimacy with her in that moment of like, oh, we're in this like cyclical pattern and path. Yeah.
Can't believe you don't know the names of your grandparents. That's so interesting.
Oh, it's like so common. When I was talking to my friends, it's like we don't know, like the proper names of people are just not important. It's like we call everyone by their position to us, rather than by a name. And I think, and that is exactly what directly transfers on to the next generation. So that's something that kind of, I feel like, again, is like that tether. Yeah.
Yeah. And as you say that, there are certain phrases in the book or sentences. And I thought, I wonder if that was like her. So like one would be, the can that it's a cartoon bear indented to the lid of the tin and the blue paint that had been battered off. And I was wondering, I wonder if she had that when she was a kid. I wonder.
No, that was made up. But actually what that's based on are those like blue circular tins of cookies. Those variety cookie packs. I don't know where the bear came from. That was totally made up. But I do remember those tins. but definitely the description is like, very inaccurate to what I was actually, what I've actually seen.
Yeah, there was always a variety. And my brother and I always liked the same one. So what would you And all the other ones will still be full. there's a lot of, and this is not spoiling anything because it's been the other reviews, but how did the love story between the two girls, how did it first enter your mind? Because it's not that it's shoved in there. It's very tangible and alive and moves the right way. But how did you decide that that was going to be a central part, could call it the central part of the book?
Yeah, it is definitely one of the running threads of the book. Actually, initially, it was a very kind of like blip in the book of like it lasted a chapter and then it was gone, or, she moved away. And I realized that it was because I was having difficulty imagining their future together, and I wanted to kind of overcome that challenge internally for myself. And so it became a challenge to write them in this way that I think, is so beautiful. And also one of the relationships in the book that feels really, that feels so, I mean, they're all generative relationships, but maybe a little bit less conflicted, I think, than the other relationships in the book. So it became like actually something that I was really proud of writing afterwards, because I felt, oh, I finally kind of fully imagined them in this way, and it felt so important for me as a writer, and also for the character. And I just realized, like, I wanted them to kind of be partners in crime in this way, and for their relationship to not be the central conflict, but to be more like a refuge, I think, in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so when you came up with the various devices, although that's not a good word to use for them, but like listening to you talking about intergenerational things, and the way that translated into the book was these letters coming out of holes. And how did you decide that device, if you will, was the manner in which you were going to link the past, present, and future together?
Well, it's interesting because the letters were originally found in that tin that you were mentioning. Because I didn't have the holes yet. Like, the holes came very late in the revision process. So I was like, I don't know, the letters are like taped into this tin or to the bottom of this tin. I was like, she finds them. It was very contrived. I guess I was really interested in there's a lot of talk about literacy in the book too, and the grandfather not reading or writing, but the grandmother having learned from the missionaries how to write the Romanized alphabet. And so I was really interested in these very like imperfect translations, very fractured, very fragmented, that I think reflects all the different fragments of language that the grandmother has acquired. And I just felt like her voice was, her very direct voice is really necessary in the book. And I was also just interested in the idea of translation, because I was like, it's all about like the impossibility of translation, and how incoherent it can be sometimes, not just translating, between, you know, generations or, languages, but just, yeah, just like communication when there's so much being like carried and held within these characters. I was like, oh, I want something for Ben and Daughter to be able to collaborate on, but that doesn't feel clean or perfect. Like, there's always a level of mistranslation, a level of theatrics, and it's just, a very indirect form of discourse and communicating, which I enjoyed, yeah.
Well, for example, like that love story, it does translate figuratively into things, and you've been asked this before, into themes that are present in our current society or in the debate last night.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, there are things that are exactly, the words are different, but the things that are happening are exactly the same now.
Exactly.
And it's poignant, but... you know, it's just interesting how that, okay, so, owning a bookstore, so this book will probably be one of our book club picks.
Oh, wow, thank you.
I call the book club Fight Club.
Oh, I love that, yes.
Because I always feel like reaching across the table and throttling someone. you're not interpreting it right. Or they'll go, why would she do that? Why would she use that line? You know, it's
so funny, yeah.
And speaking of violence, that's, you know, there's a lot of violence. Like, let me think of one. Oh, yeah, when the father is taking the hose, and I can visualize this perfect with the little metal end, and he's, like, slamming it here, and the brother's eyes are rolled back. But it's kind of like the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. There's, you know, an anvil falls on his head, but it doesn't really do anything.
Right.
It's just, and there's tons of violence like that. Or even, like, we're getting ready to shoot Bob to get the gold out.
Yeah.
And so you stuck that all in there.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have the same consequences it would have in the real world, which is exactly what ethical realism is about. So, we're talking about excrement and urine and violence.
Yeah.
So really, that's why I was saying it's not the book you would ever expect to read. Because the emotions that you expect to have from this type of action aren't the emotions that you actually end up having.
Mm.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. That's so interesting. I agree. Like, I think that's one of the things that I'm really interested in other people's work as well. We mentioned Gabriel Garcia Marquez, this idea of it goes in this direction that feels completely unexpected and surprising. And that the consequences for action often feel really inexplicable. And I was really interested in that kind of inexplicability. I'm really interested in narrators that feel like they're at the eye of a storm and that they can't quite comprehend everything that's whirling around them. And it feels like there's no sense or context to it, but then they kind of slowly discover what that context is. I agree. And I think the way I wanted to write violence too was I was really afraid of just kind of re-traumatizing in a way, or just being really exploitative with the violence, and for it to feel totally, like exploitation. And what I was really interested in is transformation, and like what comes after, like the act itself, like rather than the act itself, but like, What does it mean to come from generations of that violence? Like, what kind of magic or transformation is possible? And I don't think necessarily that healing is possible or that severing oneself from that kind of inheritance is possible. But those were kind of my intentions.
And the interesting thing is, coupled with the violence, and there's an enormous amount of humor. Almost laugh out loud humor.
Yeah.
And it's interesting the way you wove that into the book as well.
Yeah.
If that's what your intent was.
Oh, that was completely my intention. I'm so relieved when people say that they thought it was funny, because I was like, yes, that was what I was trying to do. Like, when people are like, oh, such serious themes, like so much darkness, I was like, oh, really? Because it was actually, it's so strange to say, but it was such a joy to write. Like, it was completely like magical to write this book. Really difficult, definitely points where I was like, oh man, this is really intense. But I wanted the language to feel really playful. I come from a family that's just like hilarious, like incredibly funny. Like, my mom should have been a stand-up comedian, and we all believe that, and she also believes that. Like, we all just like completely support it. And where, you know, darkness and humor are just completely intertwined. And humor is like embedded in everything that I grew up with and am surrounded by. So I was like, I want to pay a little bit of tribute to that and to make it feel not like playful. Yeah.
Did your mom like the book?
Oh, well, she really enjoys, like, she's very into like thrillers and like murder mysteries. Like, she really likes this Chinese writer who, I really wish he would get translated, actually. But he writes like about like corrupt officials and murderers, and it's very like plotty. I think she really enjoys like a really good plot, and I'm like, that's not me. But of course, she's proud. But maybe I'll have to write like a mystery thriller for her.
Well, the thing about thrillers and romance novels is that they end and the reader, especially thrillers, generally, they end and you know what's happened.
Mm.
Things tied up, it's in a box, you know, wrapped up. And yours is completely different. You know, it's like,
right,
you're letting the reader, you throw this out there like your firstborn. And then you're letting the reader, well, especially with magical realism, you're letting the reader do a lot of work, or the reader to do a lot of work.
Yeah.
Which is the best kind of book, I think.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it is a lot from the writing perspective, but it is very much just me being like, I don't know the answers. Like, I have no idea. This is all detailed doubt. That's all I can give.
Did you do a big outline of this before, or did it just...
Absolutely not. Completely not. I have never outlined anything in my life, and I pray every day to be an outliner. It would be really nice to have some feeling of where it's going. No, this came out in pieces and fragments, and I actually had to kind of stitch it together and find its shape. And my editors and I went through endless iterations of different orders, different structures. This is completely in like an opposite order. The first piece in this book was in the very end. Wow. One of the end sections was the very beginning. Yeah, that first section with Mother in Arkansas was going to be the last chapter of the book for some reason. I had no idea where I was going with it. It was a process of exploration.
Was the editing process fun for you, or was it excruciating then?
Oh, it was a mix. It was fun whenever I got to generate something, because I really enjoy like drafting new things and just playing around with different ideas. But it was excruciating when it came back to like revisiting what was actually on the page. I think at a certain point, like the manuscript came in at 70,000 words. And wow. During my first revision, I wrote an extra 60,000 words. So at one point, the book was 130,000. So basically, I wrote it twice. So I sent in 70K. They said, here are your edits on your 70K. I got it back. I wrote an extra book and was just slapped it onto the end of the first book and was like, is it edited now? Is it fixed? So my way of editing is just, I just add more. Or I just like completely, I just add more. At one point, I like wrote a script, like, there was an entire 40-page section that was just in script, like movie script. And I was like, I don't know, why not? The actual editing process is very against my process, which is just like word vomit all the time.
Well, it's funny because most of the authors I interviewed, the editing process is honing and pairing and and that's why the authors are always so pissed off, because it's like, it's like being on the cutting room floor in a movie, you know, you did a great scene, or you're an actor who was in the scene and then you're gone, you're not in the movie anymore. That's the usual process I encounter.
A lot was cut in the end though, because I ended up getting it down from 130K to like 60 something K. And some of it was hard to let go of, but I was just also so relieved, because I was like, you know what? If I cut it, it means I don't have to fix it anymore. Like, I don't have to make it good. So cut it. It's fine. Like, we can just excise it and never worry about it again. And that was a huge relief.
Is it out of your head? Is it? So it's just, when you do that, it's just kind of gone. That's what happens with me. Once I let it go, thank God, it's just kind of, I don't remember it.
Yeah, I mean, people say to say things, but I also think, like, there are certain things you know are just like, yeah, this is ready to go. Like, this does not need to be saved. We can let it die in the other Word doc. Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about not outlining. I always envied, when I was in college and I had the big textbook, I always envied the people that highlighted everything with that yellow highlighter. Mm. But I could never do it, because if I did it, I would do the whole page.
Yeah.
That made no sense at all. So I couldn't find the parts that needed to be highlighted. So it was, and also I didn't take notes either, which was, I regret it at some points, but.
It's so funny.
So from what I read, you have a chap book. I don't know. It's not out yet, right?
Not out yet.
And you're writing short stories as well?
Yeah. I'm writing short stories right now. Working. I mean, a lot of them have been published online. And yeah, I have a micro chapbook. It's like 20-something pages, very short. That's a retelling of Wuthering Heights. I guess I can't get away from retellings. I guess I'm just going to forever just retell things. Because I have no idea of plot and structure. So I'm like, yeah, let's just write some fan fiction and just take someone else's structure. So that'll come out. That'll be out in 2021, the Wuthering Heights miniature retelling. And the short stories are they're very messy, but I'm enjoying the shorter form for sure.
When you are in the shorter form, do you still do it? Are you going to continue to do it this way for the rest of your career, writing in terms of magic, in terms of things that can't possibly happen but do?
Oh, completely. I've never written a realist thing in my life. Actually, that is a lie. I wrote one like realist short story that was published, and I like remember to tell everyone when I sent it to my friends. I was like, this is the one and only realist story you will ever read from me. Read it and treasure it. It's never happening again. And it's also not very good. and they did like it. But yeah, forever. Like, I think I can't write without that. Like, that is what drives my writing. It's like almost like, oh, write something without words, like write something without something magical happening. Like, I can't do it. It's, yeah, it's very much the aesthetic and what I'm interested in. Yeah.
Wow, you're so sure of yourself.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, who knows? I can definitely change. I'm very open to that. But I think for now, like, but I think even with writing realism, there are still sometimes aspects of, like, myth or memory that feel a little bit imbued with magic. So, like, even when I do write realism, which actually I have been doing a little bit, dabbling in, like, there are still elements that feel a little bit, you know, exaggerated or absurd. Yeah.
Well, how do you feel? Well, you know, in the introduction, I go, basically, your first love is poetry, because I think I heard you say that one interview. And so you're still, I assume you're still doing that, but how did you decide, okay, I'm a poet and now I'm just going to go ahead and do this?
Yeah.
And like I said, and this is true of several authors I've interviewed, if they're poets, then it's much easier to translate into the type of lyrical book that this is. Kind of makes perfect sense, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I do, when I write poetry, it oftentimes becomes very narrative,
yeah,
and kind of spirals out into, like, my favorite thing that I've written in poetry, which after I wrote, I was like, I don't have to write poetry anymore. This is all I wanted to do. I'm okay now. Was like 5-6 pages, and it was very narrative. It had a plot. So I think, like, both to me are just very similar, and that I'm very drawn to language and the possibilities of language. And then everything kind of spirals out from there. And yeah, the prose I write sometimes takes on poetic elements, and the poetry I write sometimes takes on very prose-y elements, or elements of fiction. And that kind of crossover feels really natural. And yeah, I think when I was writing the novel, I had an eye towards fragmentation and toward letting language lead. That comes from poetry, which I think values a lot of mystery and not necessarily thinking, oh, what does it mean? Like, where is it going? Like, what is it? It kind of really values the fragment and values just unknowing and wonder. And I wanted to kind of bring that spirit in. Yeah.
Yeah, it is kind of like the canon, because poetry has evolved so much that you didn't expect to be reading a poem that sounds like a story. It sounds like this is what is happening to me right now, or this is what happened to me in the past and how it affected me. It's just like fan fiction. It's just something a generation ago you wouldn't have seen. And I would normally say, you're in the 5 under 35 and all the other awards you've gotten. And how old are you anyway?
I'm 22.
Jeez, I can't believe you did this. what I was going to say is that if you continue in this vein, it seems as if you're going to come across something that's like an invention, like Elon Musk, that you're going to come across something that kind of puts a dent in the universe, like Steve Jobs and Elon Musk did. I mean, especially you're 22 years old, so you got a career of 50 years ahead of you. So it seems like you're going to do something meta or breaking the fourth wall without people. The fourth wall is broken.
Well, that would be really fun. Like, I hope I become more kind of experimental. I never want to get tired of what I'm writing. That happens a lot where I'm starting something. I'm like, oh, I've done this before so many times. Like, I think I'll always kind of be chasing that feeling of wanting to surprise myself. And I hope I'm able to kind of continue pushing myself. But yeah, I mean, it's really, really just honored to have also, like, have this platform and have this book out. Like, I think it's, I never could have imagined it. Like, it's still really shocking to me. But,
And also, it's a shame that because of COVID, you can't be doing what a first author would do, unless you did it before. You can't be out.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mind that, actually. I think because, you know, I didn't really have a literary kind of community growing up. There wasn't really a bookstore near me. And so all of the ways that I encountered authors were through YouTube, through online. through social media too. And so it kind of feels like going back to my roots, because when I was, you know, a young writer trying to, or wanting to like read and write a lot, like that was my way into the literary world, wasn't actually in person. It was actually through all of this, through all of these digital spaces. And then I found my way into those physical spaces. So I'm happy that like in a lot of ways, this digital like platforming is more as really accessible in certain ways. But yeah, I do really wish I could connect with people physically too, because there's so many people I want to like run up to and like squeal with. But
you don't yet have to worry about the woman in the line waiting to have you sign a book who wants to tell you her life story and spend 20 minutes when all these other people.
I wouldn't mind that though. I mean, it's in the spirit of the book too, but I come from such a storytelling family, and we are very talkative, and I love listening to people tell their stories. And I would be like, oh yes, tell me the story of your life. I would probably encourage it, which is not good. maybe not good. I don't know.
Your age is good for me, because unless I've exasperated you, because I can interview you another six times, except I'll die in the meantime. I'm afraid to get another pet because I don't want my damn pets to outlive me. It's very.
Oh, no.
And I have these two peacocks, and I didn't know when I got them. They live to be 40 years old, and I hate them, and they hate me. It's like
peacocks live to be 40?
Yeah, I didn't know.
That's shocking.
So they're gonna come to my funeral, and they're just gonna be laughing at me. I have, my whole life is magical realism. I have. I have peacocks, goats, cats, alpacas, chickens, roosters, and like sometimes I'll go up in the morning and they're all together and I know they're talking about me. I know.
This does sound like a story. This sounds like a great short story. I used to have chickens as well. They live to be quite long too. They can be like 14 years old. Probably not all of them, but I love this. This is a story.
I know, everyone always tells me that. And then I'm really good at narrative. I'm really good at character, but I never have an actual beginning, middle, and end. But you kind of didn't have to look.
I don't have a beginning, middle, or end. All of these pieces were just shuffled randomly until someone was like, this makes this kind of the most sense. And we're like, let's go for it.
That's true. Cause you said the end, the beginning was the end. And
yeah, completely. It was reshuffled a million times before, during the editorial process. Yeah.
All right. Well, it was so cool talking to you, and it's such a great book. And I didn't realize you're only 22, which really makes me jealous, because I still want to write the great American novel. Not gonna happen. But it's nice having a bookstore, because it makes everybody happy. So just like you were with your library.
Yes, exactly. I'm so glad now to be living near-ish a bookstore compared to when I was growing up. It means it's like a completely different world. Thank you for all the work that you do, and for your support of the book as well. It means a lot to me.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on today.
Yeah, of course. This was so much fun.
Hope to talk to you soon.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.